the only social media platform that matters.
You realize I've started to edit that out.
Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 222nd episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of Stools & More, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Diami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop and Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop. Tonight, we're talking with Kim McIntyre of McIntyre Furniture, a professional woodworker and outdoor enthusiast. So welcome to the show, Kim.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Great.
Thank you for joining us. Well,
absolutely.
Yeah, and we'll get started. So what's in the shop, Diami?
Well, in the shop, I have a small little commission I'm doing for my accountant. He moved offices and got this new sign that was all done on CNC, and it's all the letters of the company name on these really cheap little threaded rods that are kind of epoxied into the back of each CNC'd letter. And it came with a form that you're supposed to tape to the drywall, drill holes through the form into drywall, and then if you drill the hole of the right diameter, the threaded rod just kind of sticks into the drywall and holds it, and there's no fasteners of any real sort.
Really?
Yeah. And I talked to him about that. I was like, well, we can just attach it into the wall, but I thought it was much better to attach it to an actual backer, and then I can make it hang on the wall, and, you know, you ever move or want to change or whatever, you just take it down and can put it back up, and we can do whatever. So it's all a painted piece, so I'm making it out of a sheet of half-inch MDF. It's nothing fancy, but because I need enough space behind the backer to mount French cleats and nuts and things to attach these, because I'm actually going to put nuts and washers, nuts and washers on the back of the thread rods to attach it, I'm ripping strips of the half-inch MDF and gluing them around the outside, so almost like making a frame. So on the edge, it'll be an inch and a half thick. It's three layers thick, and in the middle, it's just the single half-inch. So right now, that's sitting on the bench with one of those long strips glued up. I did that on Saturday, on Sunday night, because actually over Thanksgiving weekend, we were out camping earning frost points.
Bad time to be a Boy Scout.
It was fine. My tent didn't leak. I don't know.
There you go.
Hey,
there
you go. That's what's important.
I think we convinced a lot of people to buy new tents.
It's always good to stress test them. Then you know. Yeah.
But that's all that's going on. It's not a particularly complicated project, and it has put the entertainment center kind of on hold until I get it done. And actually, just to talk about the entertainment center for one moment, I think I might not put the second coat of epoxy over the top surface. I'd mentioned that while the initial epoxy filled the vast majority of the pores, there were a couple spots where there were slight recesses, and it wasn't completely smooth the way I wanted it to be. Mm-hmm. But I've managed to lose my mixing ratios for the epoxy. Now, I know it's one pump to one pump for the two different components of part A and part B, but I don't remember how many pumps I was putting into the big mixing jar. I think it was three of each, or maybe it was six of each. I don't know. And then I have the glass fiber thickener, and I don't remember how many spoonfuls of that I was adding to get the right consistency, and I don't know how many drops of dye I was adding to then that mixture. Somewhere I wrote it down, and I can't find it. So I would have to kind of play with a couple of batches to make sure I get it reasonably close. It doesn't have to be exactly the same, but at least reasonably close. And then I need to put a coat of it on, which means pulling all these slabs out of the shop and restacking them and clearing the top and applying the epoxy, and then get that sanded off. Now that I've sanded everything else off, and I would have to do all of that prior to Christmas, because over the Christmas break, I'm taking all the individual components, which at this point now are, let's say, 90% ready. All the joinery is done. I just have more sanding to do, and then they're completely ready. But I'm going to take them all to my to work, because we have a big warehouse, and we're closed Christmas to New Year's. So I'm going to crank up the heat in the warehouse and try to do my finishing in the warehouse at work rather than in my driveway in December. Mm-hmm. So that's where things stand on the entertainment center. And in an effort to actually get it done this century, I think I'm going to live with not putting a second coat of epoxy on that top one to make it perfectly last smooth. It'll be pretty damn close.
I was going to say, after all, it will still have the appearance of being timber strand on edge.
Oh, yeah.
Which definitely has micro voids all over it. You filled in a grand majority of them. It'll be understandable if you see a few. And you probably won't even once you put it in the shower.
Yeah, probably, probably you're right 2 foot away. You're not going to see anything.
Yeah, you're not going to see it.
Yeah. Well, that's great.
Yeah. So what are you working on, Kyle?
Well, I'm working. I told you I was doing a working on a commission for a friend of mine. So I think we decided on some on the roundish stools. So I'm building one more because I had some changes to make to that one. So I am. I guess this would be prototype two, so to speak.
Wouldn't it be? It's the second version of one of your two prototypes.
Yes, yes. So, so I'm making that. I'll probably start on it here. Probably actually tomorrow if I find some time. I need to glue up a seat blank and get started. And then the other project I'm working on is boxes for Christmas presents. And I was thinking about making turned boxes, but I think I'm just going to make square boxes. I've been going through Matt Kinney's book, and I think I might just steal one of his designs and make some little square boxes.
You're not going to do the Swiss cheese one, are you?
No.
That was awesome. But it is awesome. Way complicated.
But I need to make three of these. I need something simple that I could just batch out. So I went through my wood pile yesterday and pulled out some wood that I can resaw. So I'm probably going to start on those as I wait for the seat blanks to dry or the seat blank to dry. I'll probably start resawing, and we'll see if I can do two projects at once without getting them too confused. And then the last thing I'm doing is skew practice on a lathe with a skew. Anyone that follows me on Instagram, I've taken some shots. So I'm trying to basically practice on one turning blank a day. Unfortunately, I missed a day, so I've only done four at this point in time. But getting better. Been watching a lot of videos, primarily Pete Galbraith's spindle turning video, which has been fantastic. And I've also caught a couple of lectures by Alan Lacer. I think he's well known in the wood turning community for skew and other instructions. And so he has a couple of videos out there, one on YouTube, one on Vimeo, where he does some lectures. But it's gotten to the point now where I'm watching the videos over and over again, but I'm looking at, okay, what's a hand placement? How fast is he moving the skew? Is he right-handed or left-handed? You know, all these kind of things just to try to narrow down. But I understand why people hate the skew, because I think it's just got a tremendously, I don't know about tremendously, but for me, a long learning curve. I'm not really worried about catches. I got that mastered. I'm not having any issues with any catches, but it's just a learning curve on getting the right technique. What I'm primarily trying to do is I think it's called a planing cut, where you really smooth the wood and it comes off looking basically like it's been sanded to 800 grit, and you don't have to do any sanding to the piece. So I'll do one pass, it's perfect, and the next pass will be a little bumpy. So, it's one of those things.
Are you finding... Go ahead.
As a turning virgin, you're describing how there's a steep learning curve to the skew. Is that why you want to get over that learning curve? Because you can get these really smooth results that don't require sanding?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Because I think I might have mentioned this once before, but, I can turn out the legs fairly easy, but they require sanding. And when I sand, it just destroys my shop. I wish there was a way I could do it outside, but there really isn't. And basically, it's, after I completely sand three or four legs, then I need to actually open up all the doors and get the leaf blower out and blow out my shop. It gets that messy. So I'm trying to you know, learn the skew so I can cut down on the sanding.
There you go. And I know you've said previously that you're working on poplar in this practice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How often are you going back to touch up the edge of that skew chisel as you're going through this? So each session or not even that often or?
Yeah. Before each session and probably at least once, maybe twice during the session.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the skew's different. You know, a lot of people, you know, will go right off the grinder and start turning. But the skew actually benefits from being honed a little bit. From my understanding is it doesn't have to be honed. You know, you can go from the grinder and then hit it with like a 600 grit diamond stone, which is if you got those little paddles, it's the red one. Mm. And just hit it on both sides of that. And then you also want to hit it on the edges to get the 2 points and then go from there. So I'm starting to experiment with that. And actually say, okay, what happens if I actually take it to my diamond stones up to, you know, say 4,000 and then go to a strop and see if it works any better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would think off the grinder, maybe a strop would be enough, but.
Yeah. Huh. So I'm kind of experimenting with that. There are different schools of thought out there, but, you know, I think basically it just takes practice and, fair. You know, yeah, a lot of practice.
It sounds like you're well into that practice.
Yeah, it sounds like a deep, deep rabbit hole.
I feel like I just started, actually. But anyway, so Sean, so what's going on with you?
Not much. You know, as we are recording this, we're just past Turkey Day here in the United States. And so I enjoyed some time with my family and took advantage of decent weather the day after on Black Friday. I didn't buy a damn thing, but I got my Christmas lights up. So there. my dad retired about 2 months ago, and he's a good patriotic kind of guy. And there is a local lawyer / woodworker that I saw a little story on that makes these beautiful carved wooden American flags.
Okay.
If you look him up on Instagram, it's I think his handle is You May Approach the Bench.
Oh, okay.
which is funny because he's a lawyer, right? But he did his thing at our local hardwood supplier, Kenwood. Ken Craft Woodward. They did a big thing in there, and he was making like a 5x8 ash and padauk, like, you know, lay it up like it's basically like a giant cutting board, except then he takes grinding wheels to it. And cuts waves into it.
Oh, wow.
And it looks super cool. And so.
Is that like the thing that Paul Jackman just made?
Did he make it wavy?
Yes, that's exactly what he did. That's what he was doing at Maker Faire. That was the demo he was attempting to do while not talking to people.
Okay, then very possibly. I don't know that I caught that. But it's I don't actually know how he did this, how this guy does the star field of a flag. Mm. But it. Looking into it, and I was like, oh, now I'll like commission one of those for my dad, but like it's expensive, and I get it because it takes time. So I'm considering doing like making one or looking into making one of those. It'll be not nearly huge, but like it's such a cool idea, and I want to Dave make something. Dave Pajuto is in my area, and I know he's got a CNC mill, so I think I might be able to utilize that for like some star fields, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
See if you can convince him to cut stuff on the laser too.
I know I could. And actually that might work as well to cut the stars
out.
Yeah,
that
could work. You know, so I'm thinking like what materials I want to use, what it wants to look like. Cause the guy you may approach the bench guy, he paints the blue on. And I want to find like a gray wood and just make it look aged, you know, that kind of thing. Just natural wood colors that will exhibit a flag. It doesn't have to be red, white, and blue necessarily, but.
Yeah. Well, Diami might be able to send you some blue tinted.
You know, that's true. Yeah. You got.
I would be happy to and highly recommend it. But the only blue timber strand I have is a prize winning hardwood derby car.
Yeah, right. No, and from what I've seen, what it takes to smooth epoxy in stabilized timber strand.
The 24 grit sanding belts help.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The profile sander, I don't have the, no, not going to do that.
Well, anyway. You only need the profile sander if you were stupid enough to round over curves. The edges of your inch and a half thick slabs.
That's true. But I thought you would be interested because, I mean, it has me, this is the closest I've ever been to thinking about doing some freehand carving, like power carving. Yeah, because he power carves his stuff.
I can't say enough good things about it. I think power carving is fantastic.
I know. Mm-hmm. I think that's an outdoor project for me. But
I hear you've got a garage you could do it in.
It's full of shit, though. The dust is no better out there than down here.
Do you have a leaf blower?
I do. I do.
You could power carve in front of a fan.
Yeah, there you go.
You got sons. Anyway. Have them hold the vacuum.
Yeah, right? Hey, kids, put this mask on and hold this vacuum. Oh, anyway. So, Kim, how about you? That's got to be, you got to do better stuff than me.
Well, maybe. No, I've been, prior to Thanksgiving, I was cranking hard on making my classic tea box, which is just a nice decorative countertop box that has a ton of dividers in it that I sell on Etsy, of all places. That's where I got started with my store. And so I was working hard to produce as many as I could. And then, I took all of Thanksgiving, that full week, to do vacation time with family. So I guess I'm coming back relaxed right now. But, my day job is managing a wood studio at this place called Pratt Fine Arts Center here in Seattle. So, I've had all the emails and scheduling, 5 months out and everything that I'm working on coordinating with all of my instructors. So that's keeping me busy. And then as far as woodworking coming up on the horizon, I've got 2 more commissions for tea boxes that I need to finish. And then hopefully I get that done by the end of the year. And then it looks like I've firmed up doing a kayak build for a local customer.
Oh,
so
that's very cool.
Yeah.
That's nice. In strip kind of canoe fashion?
No. It's a style called stitch and glue. So it's definitely not as involved. There's a local company out in Port Townsend, so out on the Olympic Peninsula, that makes these kits. So it is like a marine grade plywood. So there's plenty of connecting pieces together and, you still get the mold similar to like what you've seen, canoe makers use. So you use that form. But because they're a little bit more larger pieces, it's a little bit less involved. You still go through all the fiberglass and your elbows and wrists are tired from all the sanding, getting all those, sparing all the seams. I think it'll take me a good 3 or 4 months to still finish it. This one might take a tiny bit longer because it's actually going to be 3 cockpits. So that's just a lot more build-out time.
Wow. Yeah. So it's going to be long.
Exactly. So right now, this week, I'm actually focused on clearing the clutter that has acquired in the shop. You know how you just bounce from project to project and you slowly give up space in your shop to things that you don't fully put away or new tools that haven't found their permanent home. Mm-hmm. So I'm regaining surface space and, workaround space. That's what's going on.
That's Pygmy is the company?
Yeah. And that's
That's the picture you have in your handle on Instagram.
Exactly.
On Skype. That's what we're using.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the one, my first one I did all the way through. And then the bug for making these kayaks bit me from a friend who had started one. And then it got totally put on pause because of life. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "You're my woodworking friend. If you help me, and we make a friend date, every 2 weeks to spend a day working on it, I'll make progress." So I basically was like, this is fun, to take your woodworking, but then my outdoor enthusiasm and meld them together. And then I think anytime you can make something like a boat that you're floating in, there's just very a magical, inspiring feeling that you get.
Absolutely.
So about, it might be almost 2 years ago now, I put my list on the Pygmy Boats website as a boat builder, and right off the bat I got 2 builds, and then it's just been quiet, so there must be a lot of other great people out there making kayaks. But then a fellow this fall contacted me who's in the Seattle area and ultimately wants the boat because you know, he's looking forward to family time this spring, but probably just busyness of life and jobs is going to prevent him from, you know, committing that much time. Plus, you know, epoxy cures a lot better and a very steady environment. So I have heat in my shop space. So he was looking for a kayak builder who had a heated space and he didn't have to buy the more expensive epoxy that, you know, could do colder temperatures and that sort of thing. So, yeah.
That's very cool.
That is very cool.
If you're ever out on the, well, I suspect they probably have an equivalent thing out by you, but I saw, I believe Pygmy was there. We were at the Wooden Boat Show last year up in Connecticut. In June or July, they put out a show, and there are a dozen companies with kits like this, and they are so cool.
They are, yeah. It's, you know, Pygmy's been out there. I don't know if they were the first, but there's quite a few good companies, and I just encourage anyone that if they ever have sort of an inkling to do it, it's just so inspiring to do it. And there's so many, like Pygmy has a great video series on YouTube that really, if you're not an instruction reader, you can still get through the process. and so, yeah, I mean, you know, plenty of people have kind of made this, popularized this, you know, from the Nick Offermans to, you know, Go Out and Paddle Your Own Canoe, you know, his book. But it's a really cool feeling to be like, I made a boat.
You know? I mean, yeah, of all the rewarding things to do, I mean, you can make furniture, you can make a house, but making the thing that you can go into an otherwise unnavigable, you know, piece of earth, you know, and actually float and go, that's awesome.
Yeah, exactly. So, that's what's coming up immediately.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, I had the bug to build a canoe, and I've gone out there and looked at some plans, and I've actually looked at some of the wood kits you can buy. And, it's something that I have on my, bucket list to do.
Yeah.
Do they have water in Hill Country?
Yeah. We got all kinds of rivers around here. Lakes.
Got water now, but
yeah, we got lakes. We got everything. Yeah. So, it's not a complete desert in Texas. You know, we have all kinds of climates. We have mountains, deserts.
No, I understand that, but you're about to move from the waterfront to like what, 3 or 4 hours inland.
But that's where the Hill Country is. Yeah, there's a lot of rivers. In fact, one of the things that's real popular in the Hill Country is to go tubing down the rivers.
Mm. Oh yeah,
yeah. So, anyway, well, let's move on real quick to things that we saw that piqued our interest. I have one, and it's kind of weird. This has truly piqued my interest, and it's from a company called Raymond Innovations, and it's a soft starter for 110 equipment like routers, chop saws, circular saws. So if your machine, a lot of machines now have that soft start feature, but if yours doesn't, you can add this little device onto it that, you know, you basically, it goes on the end of your electrical cord. So you plug it into this device and then plug this device into the wall, and it's relatively small and it only costs $30, but it will add that soft start feature to all universal motor tools. And I have no use for it, but I saw it and I went, you know, there's a lot of people out there that probably have, you know, some routers. I could think of Diami that has what, 24 routers?
I only have like 12.
Okay. All right. 12. But you know,
some
if you
of
have
them
some
soft
of those,
start already.
Yeah. A lot of the new ones will, but you know, you could have some old ones that don't, and, or you could have like, chop saw, like I have a chop saw, it didn't have a soft start feature, and that's relatively new. And you know, so I just thought it was kind of interesting. So if there's anyone, okay.
Sorry, I was seeing if my chop saw had a soft start.
Does it?
The vacuum kicks out automatically with it.
Yeah. So, but I just thought it was an interesting little device to add that feature to maybe some older power tools out there. And at $30, it's fairly,
the price point, it sounds well worth trying. And I'm looking at the website now, and it talks about how it reduces mechanical stress, extending the life of your equipment. I know very little about how this would work. I'm by no means an electrician, but I have had conversations with my local toolmonger, who I get my routers from, and discussed with him how getting an aftermarket router speed adjuster, like you would put on the outside of a router table, that will, from his perspective, greatly reduce the lifespan of the router that's plugged into.
Reduce, because you're not.
I think it's amperage you're cutting from it, but one of the parts of the electric you're denying the machine to artificially slow it down. I can give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that they're actually going to extend it. But when I saw this, that's the first thing I thought of: is are you cutting power to the machine where it should have it and actually shortening the life of the machine? But again, I really don't know what I'm talking about here, so I will give them the benefit of the doubt and say that they're probably right.
Yeah. I have no idea either, but I mean, like I said, it's not something I don't think I really need, but I could definitely see where someone that might have some older power tools or something like that really wants that soft start feature, that it would be nice to have, especially, you know, older routers. I mean, I love, you know, all my routers have the soft start feature, but I can imagine if yours doesn't, it is a little bit daunting.
One of the old Porticable screamers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, $30 is not too bad.
That's not bad.
I don't want to get too much into it because while she shared it online, I don't want to get into too much details because it's not my life, but I just want to offer on behalf of all of us the absolute best wishes to Natalie Houston. Wonderful person, good woodworker, wonderful woodworker, frankly. I don't need to cut that down. But just a friend of the show. She's going through some health issues, and we just wish her the absolute best.
Yes, we certainly do. And if you want to hear a little bit more about Natalie, she was our guest a few months back. I don't know what episode number that is.
179.
179. There you go. So I encourage everyone to go out there and listen to her. She's a very enthusiastic, great woodworker, and all around great friend too. Yeah. So we wish you the best, Natalie. So we'll move on to Kim McIntyre of McIntyre Furniture and our main topic. So, Kim, I did look a little bit about your background, but why don't you go ahead and tell us, you know, how you got into the business of woodworking. You know, I'd certainly like to find out more about, you know, your education and what you currently do for your date job and your business.
You bet. Yeah, I'm excited to share it all. So I think I grew up in a really fortunate home situation where my dad felt like he could do anything. So I just immediately always had the inspiration that there was no barriers. We moved into a 100-plus-year-old farmhouse that needed lots of renovation to make it much bigger for a family of 6 kids. And so there was knocking down walls and adding additions and doing all sorts of crazy things. And he just slowly built out a wood shop in his house. And before you knew it, he was building the nice pieces in the house. So I was sort of in the background, and he was always really willing to share his interests with all of us kids. But mine wasn't too peaked at that point. I was more into sports. But then life kind of cruised along, and I ended up taking a few years off before college to kind of settle into adulthood and figure out what I actually wanted to spend my college education on. And I really got into the outdoors at that point. And so I was interested in studying that, but I chose a super alternative college to go to, very experiential. It's in northern Vermont. It's called Sterling College. At that point, I only had about 100 students for a 4-year college.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Wow. And basically, it had a heavy environmental lens on everything they did. So you were going to take economics, but you were going to talk about economics and how it was affecting the environment. And we had a lot of outdoor education classes that taught leadership as well as outdoor skills. We had a working farm where everyone did farm chores. So just very community-based. So like the idea that Instagram is community-based, I'm like, I'm on board. I know what community looks like. You know, they wanted to teach some adult skills. And so they crafted this class called Reverence for Wood. It's no longer a required class, which I'm sad to hear about. But it made every first-year student, so even if you transferred in and it was your first year at this place, you were still required to take this class, the winter semester. And the class was really free-form, that you had to just have different wood joints and three coats of finish, and your finish had to be dry for the wood show, let's say 3 months out, whatever the time frame was. And they hired somebody to come in from the community who was a great woodworker and just basically run open shop time. And then of course you had your 3 hour class every week or whatever. And so you could use somebody else's plans. You could design your own. It was like, it could be sculptural, it could be furniture based. It was really free form. So my first year, I just was like very timid, and I'm a very serious student. And so I just took on some picture frames for some prints that I'd got when I was traveling in Guatemala after high school. And so I was like, that was really cool. And then sometime in that semester too, it being so experiential that they wanted to teach whitewater canoeing. Well, the only time you go whitewater canoeing in Vermont is when the ice is going out. So mm-hmm. as soon as I finished that picture frames, I was then having to make a canoe paddle that in like 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I was going to, paddle with the ice chunks going out. And so, I quickly made a canoe paddle. All of a sudden I made 5 canoe paddles for everybody I knew, got super involved in that. And then I went down the track of working for Outward Bound after I graduated. And so I led wilderness expeditions in the Rocky Mountains of Montana. I chased snow basically all summer, of trying to hike up high with a snow axe and teaching people how to self-arrest and have these crazy adventures. And then I'd go to winter and in northern Minnesota and teach dog sledding, cross-country skiing, taught some whitewater canoeing in the summertime as well. But eventually I got a little worn down as far as saying goodbye to all the important people in my life. Like I just had to put, friendships and dating relationships on hold for a solid 4 months, twice a year, because mm-hmm. I was working. And so I was just ready to show up more and be present, even though I love the grand wilderness adventures. And so I was trying to start thinking about what was coming next in my life and what things I really enjoyed. And I just really went back to that time that I was in the shop and the love of just creating and making and the problem solving. And, you basically figure out how to do wood joints based on the most functional tools you have in your space and the creativity that was there. I really like coming up with solutions in life. And so that just really transferred over. So I went back home and ended up thinking I was only going to spend there for about 4 months, but ended up staying at home for about 8 months. And my dad has slowly, went from his very simple garage of tools to having a decent set to preparing for retirement in his wood shop. And so, he's now bought the third of every version that he initially started out with. So he has a pretty decked out, pretty nice space at this point. And so he would work his day job. And then in the evenings, every evening, we would just build furniture for any family member. And so I just made piece after piece after piece, getting mentorship. And he had every catalog of woodworking magazine. And I just would read and read and read. And, I'd have to work during the daytime, but I was just living and breathing as much woodworking as I could for those 8 months. And by the time I was done with that, I was like, all right, I'm ready now for a little bit more formal training. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I chose, money comes down to some things, but also sort of what I was looking for. I was at a point in life, I didn't need another college degree, and I didn't need the formalities of writing papers about woodworking or, the great mm-hmm. woodworkers out there. And so I was really looking for something that would give me as much shop time as possible, but as little structured time, but access to really great instructors. And so I ended up in this younger woodworking school, and it's called Vermont Woodworking School, and maybe I just love Vermont a lot. But no, I grew up in Virginia, in the Shenandoah Valley is actually where I grew up. And so, but most of my, you know, from about 19 to, I don't know how, I was like 22 or so when I, until I graduated college, I just lived in a lot of places in New England and really close to Vermont a lot of that time or there. So I ended up signing up for a 12-week intensive at Vermont Woodworking School, which I also liked. Like, I could just show up for 3 or 4 months, get this intense experience, and then if I enjoyed it, I could tack on more time, you know, sign up for the next semester worth of things. And being the person I am, I didn't want to have to deal with housing. And they had the option of, like, you could, you know, stay in one of their housing situations. So I didn't have to find this temporary living situation. So it was just a nice mix of, I mean, there's so many great woodworking schools out there, but it allowed me to get a bit more formal training, but without needing to commit 2 years or full year, you know, just a bigger intensity of time. And so they have structured their curriculum that you have your own open bench time, but then you, all of their instructors are doing short intensive classes. So 1 day, 5 days, whatever kind of makes sense. So you could plug in as many intensives as you wanted, but you weren't forced into any of that. So if you didn't want to learn steam bending, you just kept working on your personal projects and had access to, like, the master artist that was just, you know, maintaining the open shop space.
Or how could you not want to learn about steam bending?
Well, I of course took steam bending. I was not interested in, like, learning how to carve, like, the Queen Anne, you know, cabriolet leg. And so I was like, that's not where I'm going. So I of course took steam bending. I learned how to bake in veneer, you know, like, I learned some cool techniques for sure. But there was a few things I wasn't into, relief carving at that point or things of that sort. So, at that point, I thought I was going to head more towards the, like, live edge, heavy slab tables, and I made one for myself, but then I ended up, the next stop was with my partner. We moved to Denver, and she started grad school there, and I found a great maker space, and all of a sudden, I lived in a tiny little house, and, you know, I could do a lot of things in that maker space, and it took them a very short amount of time to be like, and now we're hiring you. so that was really cool that, you know, it had a reasonable wood shop. I won't say it was off the hook, but, I got to learn a little bit about CNC routers as well as learn about, a CNC mill, CNC plasma. There was a laser cutter. There was even a car lift in the space. Like, it was really widespread.
Wow.
And all of a sudden I got networked into this awesome community, and I was walking around Denver and I was like, I know who made this public piece of art. I know who made this hand banister at this place. I know who made this restaurant sign. Like, it just, like, all of a sudden, because I was around all these skilled people using the space, I just put so much value into, like, that artist community that maybe I wasn't the metal worker, but I knew 3 or 4 metal workers that, you know, could do something for me if I ever needed to, or just valued all of a sudden all of these other craft skills besides just woodworking. And so we were there for 3 years, started my Etsy store, selling the small boxes that I could tote back and forth from my house, you know, that kind of got me going. And then when I moved out here into to Seattle, my wife was the one who was going to look for certain jobs. So I had about 2 months before we even knew, like, where in Washington state we'd end up living, that I could just meet woodworkers out here. And so I just started getting out there and saying hello to people. You know, I was just, that's sort of, I feel like, the beginning of when Instagram was starting to get a little bit more activity. That was around 2014. And so if anyone was in Seattle and on Instagram at that point, I was connecting with them. But, you know, good old internet research about any woodworkers out here. And so I ended up working for a place out here, it wasn't the most inviting environment, so I wasn't too upset when that job went away at the end of the summer. And so I decided that I would take a launch and really start my own thing. Like I felt like I had enough skills and that we were looking for a permanent house to move into and buy. And I was ready to get dedicated to starting my own like full-time business.
Okay.
But I'm not a very competitive person and I really like spending time on my projects. And so I try to go down a different avenue of how to do this. And so I went down a long road of wanting to specialize in something that woodworkers stay far, far away from, at least commercially. And that was cribs. And it was a really great road. Woodworkers stay away from it due to the liability. And so I just really feel like I'm a very studious person. I'm a very stubborn and dedicated and hard worker that I could figure out how to crack this nut. And so I ended up partnering with somebody that could help me come up with original crib design because I do not feel like I have that artistic. Like I would have just gone to Pinterest and tried to smash like 10 ideas into one. So I kind of brought somebody who was really focused on the design aspect in and I hired him to help me through that design process for my initial crib. And from there, we went through a few prototypes and finally I felt solid enough with what we came up with and the repeatability of it that I sent it away to a testing lab. I wanted credentials for what I was making. I wanted to really deal with that liability issue.
Okay.
And so there's a whole safety standards. I wouldn't say organization, but basically anybody who wants like any standards on things, and that goes from fireproof clothing to, you know, they have a whole organ or part of their, for like even cement work, for buildings, you know, like all sorts of standards that are set not only in the US, but around the world.
Right.
They have a code book, like it's got to pass this or that. And so, and then they have private testing labs. So, the closest children's furniture testing lab was in Chicago. And so I had to ship away my crib and get it set, safety tested. And I easily passed the mechanical testing. I think any woodworker, if you've ever gone into a big box store and, you know, seen the cribs and how flimsy they are, it's pretty easy to overbuild a crib and still make it not look chunky. You know, it's basically don't use knots in your wood, is like the easiest thing, but you know, there's definitely spacing and sizing and those types of things. But the thing I couldn't figure out how to do was to get insured. And I tried super hard, but I just was realistic about how many cribs I could produce in a year. Mm-hmm. And it was such an opposition that basically I only got two people after months and months of making any phone call I could to an insurance company to even give me a quote. So, you know, well over $10,000 a year just on insurance for making cribs. And so I was just like, that is just, you know,
those are going to be some pricey cribs.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
To charge, you know, that top dollar. There are some crib companies out there that are charging several thousand dollars for them to be made in the U.S. by skilled craftspeople. But I just didn't want to put all that work into branding and selling. And like, I just wasn't the whole package and I didn't have any people who were right in my immediate community to partner with that were the business people. I wanted to be the maker making quality things. And I think that is a hard thing for the custom woodworker to figure out. How do I be the person in the shop versus the person that's beating the pavement, making the sales? And if you don't have that team person in your life, it does become a lot harder to just really have a really successful business that you're not just dedicate. Like I also wanted to have some clear boundaries in my life where I could take vacations and I could spend some family time. And I think it's really awesome how much hustle there is out there in the woodworking community to make their businesses go. But I wanted more balance in what I was going to be doing. And my wife had a few medical things that came up that made, you know, that was the appropriate pause button to resort where I was spending my time. Mm-hmm. And so it's taking a few steps back. As soon as I got out here to Seattle, I started interacting at a place called Pratt Fine Arts Center, and they teach a ton of, they have a ton of mediums that they work with. Okay. It's not quite a makerspace. It's a bit more educational than that, but they have all these professional studios that then when there's not classes that they want to rent out to hobbyists, to up-and-coming emerging artists, or even to professionals who might not have this one specialized tool. So you can get checked off in all sorts of studios, you know, metal, glass, jewelry, of course, woodworking, all sorts of 2D, stone carving, you know, blacksmithing, whatever you pretty much have an interest in. If it's really focused on hand skills and trade skills, you know, as far as art is related, they've got a spot for you. And so I had actually just started renting a space out there in the wood studio shortly after I got out here to make some of my own work. And by the end of the day, the wood studio manager was like, so I'm not going to let you keep paying for the space because I really want you to be here on staff. And I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. let's see if I like driving into Seattle every day first before like I just paid for my month. Let me see if this is like a functional space for me to come to and how do I deal with traffic. There's Seattle issues. But I love the space. And so I quickly started, you know, working a little bit, just checking people off to use the studio. Okay. Pretty simple entry point. And then a few months later, he was ready to move on. So he elbowed me and said, hey, would you be interested in applying for the job here to manage the wood studio? And I thought long and hard about it, but I decided to pass at that point because I had really decided to commit myself to the crib thing. Mm-hmm. And I knew that if I split my time, even 50-50, you know, there was no way that I would see the end of that business adventure. I either needed to put everything in it or it was just always going to be a what if dream idea. Cause I had been thinking about the crib thing cause I had made for several years. Cause when I had lived in Virginia and I was in my dad's shop, one of the pieces of furniture we had actually made was a crib for my brother. And so I was pretty, ready to just give it everything I had to see if I could go down there. So I ended up tapping my good friend, Ann Briggs, you might know her, mm-hmm. Ann of All Trades.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And so she ended up being the lucky one who got that position for a few years, but eventually she had enough fires in the, or enough, what is it? Irons in the fire. that she was ready to jump into her own thing. And so luckily I got interviewed for the job and they were ready to accept me. So these days I spend my full daytime getting to plan awesome courses, you know, deal with whatever machinery needs maintenance, network with other woodworkers, find people who might be really great, interesting master artists, woodworkers to come and teach, you know, longer classes, one-off classes. And so it's been really cool to use all of those networking skills that I was, you know, building my community and through Instagram. And now all of a sudden I have a place to funnel all of that. And so I'm just immensely enjoying my day job. And then of course, you know, I'm trying to produce my little sellable, tea boxes for Etsy that just seem to, people seem to be hungry for them. I'm not quite sure how I got that lucky kind of coming up with a repeat design that, people are hungry for. So that's sort of what happens. And then very occasionally now I get to build some custom furniture.
Well, yeah, that's one of the questions I had is, you know, and looking at your site and everything is, I know you make the tea boxes, and it'll also look like you made some custom work. So as far as your professional business, where's your main revenue coming from? Is it from the tea boxes, custom work, 50-50 or?
I would say main, like, luckily, mm-hmm. I don't need to depend on, like,
right.
my own side hustle or professional businesses. I mean, at other points, obviously, I had to put way more in it. Yep. And I'll be really upfront. I was not great at charging enough for my mm-hmm. custom furniture.
I think a lot of people have that problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, I was always optimistic about how much time I'd put into it, but I think like almost every woodworker, we are a bunch of perfectionists and I think that's what really elevates our craft, but, it takes a lot of time. and so, you know, I didn't live in the paradigm of I was always you know, meeting my time goals. But I was always ending up with the desired results I was wanting or that I had dreamed of. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I was putting great pieces of furniture out there. But at this point, basically, yeah, my tea boxes are being able to supply, you know, I'm being able to afford the top tier tools that I want to improve my you know, my mm-hmm. wood studio here at the house was where I have my wood shop, and, you know, save a little nest egg if I decide to go back to that full time at some point, that, you know, there will be a nice cushion, is basically, so it's a saving place over there. I would say the tea boxes are the vast majority since, especially mm-hmm. since I started working at Pratt. But at other points I definitely had to work a lot harder at it. But mm-hmm. since I've been at Pratt, I've given myself permission to not need to, land commissions. Mm-hmm. It just mm-hmm. so happens that I love making kayaks. So I said yes to this gentleman. you mean I get to have extra fun and just mix up what I'm doing, you know, but yeah. I definitely found it. I think you've definitely had other people that, as I was listening to some of your previous podcasts, like, it is hard to produce custom furniture with the amount of time commitment it takes to draw designs, to communicate, you know, design changes, to, mm-hmm. it's just super involved. And I think maybe I just haven't gotten good enough at that business side of things. So it just felt like it just took more than it ought to, and the reward right. was less. I love the making. I love the coming up with a piece mm. that finished fit perfectly in somebody's house. But so that's where kind of the crib thing, like, I think I'm a person that does well with consistency of what I'm making. I, of course, have all these creative ideas on what I want to make for my own house, and I can, you know, dole out as much time as those projects need. But I also get really jazzed when somebody just randomly, and this summer from the Netherlands, needed one of my tea boxes, they clearly knew when they bought my tea box that it was going to be 10 weeks before I even shipped it to them. Like, mm-hmm. okay, you know, like, that's just really cool that, you know, well over 100 tea boxes have gone out there, and people, wow. and
yeah.
almost zero of those purchases have come from anybody I've known, even in my awesome Instagram community. So that's just been kind of cool that somehow, you know, I've found a little niche that's been, very replenishing, you know, like, mm-hmm. For some reason people keep coming to me for that product. And so I know that I'm getting paid what I want to be getting paid for it. And so that's been like a nice little success thing that I keep like kerplunking back into my bucket. yeah, it feels like a win all the time.
With the tea boxes, are you building them all on spec and then posting them to Etsy? Or like this one where they had to wait so long, are you building them all essentially custom for each individual purchaser?
I have a very consistent product that I'm putting out. And so I've made enough of them with different wood species that I'm like, this is the oak one with the walnut splines, but the outside perimeter of the boxes are consistent, okay. For every build. And so it's mainly subbing in wood species. And every great once in a while, like, I'm talking once every 2 years, someone will be like, can I upgrade the hinges? Or, I used to make a memory box. And so someone was like, I wanted it, you know, 3 times as deep so that I can put all sorts of memories in there. I have made a few, where people have definitely done a custom order, but for most of the part, people are just buying like the walnut tea box with the walnut, you know, top insert, mm-hmm. or panel. And they're willing to wait 10 weeks for that purchase. And then I always try to, when I'm making, my boxes, to make a small batch production run. So, you know, right now that magic number is trying to get 4 of them through the build process during those 10 weeks. Okay. And it's not unheard of that you know, another two walnut purchases will pop up during that time. And then I'll end up with one that doesn't sell and I'll kind of hold it back, or I'll go ahead and throw it up. Who knows? But I know that whatever inventory I can have between Thanksgiving and the 3 weeks after that pretty much depletes my entire inventory.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not super great at the over hustle, you know, in the fall, but I definitely am thinking about like at least one or two, ideally getting into that inventory that, you know, might make it till late November to sell. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fantastic. I mean, we're sitting here. I'm sure Diami and Sean are looking. We had show notes and questions to ask you, but I mean, you went through everyone that we had.
Yeah,
that's perfect. To ask.
People might not listen about me, but I have a few public speaking skills. You know, all those days of the wilderness instructing where I had to, like, for the first 72 hours, teach them everything they needed to know, from brushing their teeth to how to go to the bathroom in the woods. Like, maybe I know what questions are coming, so I just shared the whole story.
Very well done.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's why that one gentleman you said when you started at the first place, and I think it was Denver, that wanted to hire you at the end of the day. I think that's probably the reason why a lot of that experience and leading those outdoor expeditions or whatever you want to call them. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I've gotten a good amount of leadership skills throughout the area or throughout my lifetime. So if people are willing to literally trust me with their lives, you know, in like high risk situations as we're doing some pretty intense outdoor stuff.
I can show you how to rip and cross cut. So what are your goals for the future? I assume the crib idea is still out there if you ever get the protection from liability.
I kind of joke that the crib stuff is on a high shelf right now. I mean, I've definitely talked to a few friends that have kind of gone through how do you protect your intellectual property and how could I maybe like sell that to like one of the premier handmade crib businesses that are out there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I just haven't gotten enough push to go that direction internally for myself, but I'm definitely interested in that route. I have gone a small sidestep from that. Where I did at least work with a lawyer here in town, and we came up with a pretty solid licensing agreement for my crib plans. And because I went through the process of really designing the cribs with so many iterations for that one first design that I call the Wonderland crib, I had some really stellar plans for it. And so then I got a good... Well, then I got to make a second crib design for a family member that I'm calling the Skyline crib. And that one didn't go through the safety testing process. But, I mean, of course, I heavily used everything I'd already learned, you know. Really knew the safety procedure or the protocol. And so, you know, I made that crib. I got some nice photos taken of it. And then my friend, who is Alabama Woodworker on Instagram, he pushed me just the right amount and gave me a long enough lead time to work with this liability lawyer to get that licensing agreement. And he really asked me, would you sell me your crib plans? Because I want to make sure I make something safe, but I want to use all your knowledge. I don't want to have to spend all that time figuring things out. So I've come up with a way that I haven't been really vocal about this, but it's, you know, the side hustle of the side hustle of selling my crib plans. So I've probably sold 5 or so of them at this point. So it's not like every time I turn around, one of them's going out the door. But last night there was a crib sale, you know. So basically it's people just direct messaging me who have, you know, come across me on Instagram or my buddy Wee. And they just... for whatever reason, you know, have decided that they're going to build a crib, but they want some safety, a security blanket. And so getting, you know, my plans and currently I'm selling my plans for $100, which may or may not be high. I have no idea. Kind of looked at like what the Wood Whisperer's selling them. And of course I'm not doing the full video build, but I have plenty of photos that are in those. I just have them as my Google folders that I'm sharing with people. So I have one for each crib design, and when they pay the $100, they get access to both of them. And they're also getting maybe up to about an hour of communication time with me. So a chance to bounce back. And, you know, I want to make these design changes because of the aesthetics, but what am I compromising design wise? Or I've never done bent lamination, which one of them requires some bent lamination. Either I'm willing to go for it, or what would you suggest if I'm not willing to go for it, you know, type of thing. So they get a little bit of help to kind of get through those initial worries. And then I just set them on their own and it's been working out so far. So I've had a few people, you know, finish the build at this point. We being the most noticeable one, but there's definitely a few other of my cribs out there floating around now. So that's pretty cool.
Well, in addition to all that support, they also get the fact that you've done so much work to get to this point with the plants. I would say that is worth it. It's not something you just sat down at a desk and in an hour drew out a crib.
Not at all. No. Several prototypes, lots of jumping on cribs, a lot of assembling and disassembling them, and how do they take up the smaller footprint. You know, because cribs are going to go into hibernation at times, or you're going to send it over to your friend or family member's house, and how do you deal with that? So I eventually need to get myself pushed back into a place so that my crib plans are much more public for people to purchase. You know, there's, like, I know of this newer business called Spruce, which I think is it Anna White and Jen Winhouse? I couldn't be messing up her last name, but they are much more in the do-it-yourselfer realm, who have merged together and are really asking makers who are making plans to come and sell their plans on their site. So basically they have the crowd and the audience who's just hungry for plans. And so they are curating plans essentially. So I need to reach out to them, or, you know, just find a more public marketplace than me having to put all of that marketing energy. You know, I'll lose some off the top and maybe I negotiate a new price. But I mean, obviously if I get to that point, I'll figure out how to probably take myself out of that direct communication loop. You know, if I have a higher sales volume, I'll need to be a little bit more protective of my time. But I haven't pushed myself enough to know what, like, the opportunity just hasn't landed in my lap. I'm much more of a networking, community-based person than just a cold call and be like, hey, what do you think? Or, you know, cold email. So, I think those opportunities will eventually get to come my way on how I get this in front of more people. But I mean, in the other direction, I'm really good at looking at every side of every opportunity or where I'm at in life. I'm just flushing things out right now. So I'll have a better product when I reach a higher market, you know, or a more involved market.
Well, I think it's a great idea because, you know, I've been around the woodworking community for a number of years. Every time I've heard someone ask a woodworker about building a crib or something, everyone kind of just shies away from it just because of those liability concerns, you know.
It is, like, real. So, yeah.
And I think you got a niche there because there are a lot of folks out there, you know, whether they want to build a crib for their grandchild or their child or whatever that is, that would like to do that. And you can actually offer some plans that have been safety tested and, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, it gives them a little bit more of a peace of mind because everybody that I have seen that's asked advice on crib building has always got this, yeah, that's just not something we want to talk about.
And rightfully so. Yeah. Like, I mean, the qualities that I was looking at was
you're not going to see
millions of dollars of coverage. Like, people get upset if their kid dies in a crib. Like, rightfully so. Exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to see Fine Woodworking or Popular Woodworking magazine do a article on making a crib. It's just not going to happen.
Exactly. So, you know, I definitely was working on ways to really protect myself, but in the end, financially, I just had to say, okay, making cribs for other people is not going to happen at this point, unless I wanted to give up something, whether that is outsource the production of it, or I had to team up with somebody, you know, like there just wasn't enough to stand on quite yet for the business. I'm so fortunate that I got to go that far down the road and really explore it. But, you know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs would talk to you about the importance of pivoting and seeing where the yeses are coming from. And just because it didn't work exactly how I started out with, I've got so many options now based on my experience. And there's so few people with that experience to pivot on and figure out how to go forward. But I mean, in the meantime, one of the many jobs I didn't even talk about, you know, that kind of happened in that in-between zone is that somehow in there, I kind of got linked up with a bunch of folks that were retiring, but not able-bodied enough to set up their wood shop. So all of a sudden, I became this person in the greater Seattle area who would show up to people's wood shops and help them outfit their, you know, dust collection and help build their new workbench. You know, like, who doesn't want to do that for their job? Like, if
you're a geek,
you know, like, all of a sudden, because I was more able-bodied and knew enough about tools and how to set up a joiner, you know, like, I was being asked to come here or there for a day of work or teching at this college to help with their woodworking classes. So there are so many ways to make a living at woodworking. And I think so often we get into this, like, I make furniture or I instruct or I write, you know, the articles or do the YouTube route. But there are a lot of career paths that you can kind of become a guru in and really niche down and make it work.
Well, that's cool. That's cool.
That's incredibly similar to how I got IT roles in my company. Just showing the ability, and the guy was going on another assignment, and he handed me the keys to the closet and said, "You're it."
That's awesome. Yeah.
Oh, really? All right.
Yeah.
Crazy. Exactly.
Kim, with the cribs and the potential they offer, and the tea boxes. Let's say that you're not worried about generating income, and you've outfit everything you have to make for your house. You're not missing anything. To just get out in the shop and make something for the pure pleasure of making it, what would you want to go out and make?
Oh, fun question. I mean, you know, with the amount of boat stuff I have done and the amount of canoeing I've done, you know, a really classic cedar strip canoe is definitely in the bucket list. Just for the pure pleasure of it, a sculpted rocker, you know, is on the wish list. Not that my house needs, like, even has a spot for one, but they're just so eloquent. So I definitely have an interest in, at some point, just learning those skills and techniques. You know, as you all have talked in the past about the power carving. I think I could go just about down. I've tinkered just the smallest amount with turning, and with my current job, I have access to some phenomenal instructors. It's just carving out the time to be skilled at it. So I could definitely see doing a lot more turning just for the pure pleasure of it and wanting to really learn and hone those skills as well.
Excellent. I hear from Kyle that turning actually takes a lot of practice.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I believe that.
And I'm just doing legs for chairs. I have no interest in doing bowls or any of that nature. I just want to make chair legs.
Yeah.
So anyway, well, I'll ask this last question. I think you probably have already answered it, but is there anything else that you would like to promote that we haven't talked about?
Oh, geez. No, I feel pretty good about all the little plugs I've given.
Subtle as they may have been, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, like everybody, I'll plug my own channels. So I'm most active on Instagram, which is McIntyre Furniture. And then, you know, I have a website, but it's nothing to say rah rah, you know, it's a placeholder, it's decent, but it's not anything that's going to wow anyone, which is just mcintyrefurniture.com. and for those who don't know how to spell McIntyre, that's mcintyre. So That probably will help people.
Yeah, I liked your Roiki chair you have out there, and a good friend of mine, Jason Thigpen. So you got his leather work on that. He's great.
Yeah. I love sitting in front of the fireplace in that chair, and it was pretty fun. I started it sort of as a group build, so a crew of us here, you know, Seattle woodworkers, got together, and our friend Anne had already built one, so we had her give us the crash course on. Put it, and we all laid out our chair legs the same day, and she gave us a quick introduction. We were all pretty green to turning, so she gave us enough of a here you go moment. And then we all scattered to the wind, and a few of us have all completed our builds, and a few of us are still cheering them on, saying, you got to get back to it. But yeah, I'm pretty jazzed. Actually, good to have Jason come out here in April and teach a really he's teaching in a leather working class for 4 days.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we've titled it advanced, meaning by the time you leave, you're going to have some advanced leather working skills, but we're not actually asking anyone to come in with a deep pocket of skills. He'll spend his first 2 days teaching people how to stitch and cut and, basic trade secrets. So everyone is welcome, but it's going to be a lot of fun having him and Sarah out here, and we're going to make some crazy cool stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I feel remiss because I saw him promote that yesterday, I guess it was, and I didn't put two and two together. So that's at your place. I knew he was out there on the West Coast, but
yeah, exactly.
That's fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, we've had that in the works for, a good 4 or 5 months now, but it's just gotten to the point that we got all the details ironed out and everyone's ready to commit and we got a price tag. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, next time I see him, I'm going to tell him he needs to do one of those classes a little closer to home.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely using us as the guinea pig. He's going to work out all of, his kinks, and he's making enough molds, for a class worth. And somehow I just got the right hook in him, to come out here and do it. We're jazzed that he'll be out here for sure.
Oh yeah, he's such a great guy.
Yes.
So, well, with that said, let's move on to our fortnightly beer choices.
Nice. Lead us off, Kyle.
I'll start us off. So, y'all have heard this one before, but it's the Carbach, a local Houston brewery that was bought out by one of the big boys, but they still make a good brew. I'm drinking their IPA called Hopadillo, and
local favorite.
It's one of my favorites. It's a great all around beer.
Well, before I get to my choice, I want to just mention that Jason is on episode 89. If anyone wants to follow,
good call. Yeah,
nice chat with him. But not realizing the Vermont connection to Kim, I went with a what I think these days is probably a legend in Stowe, and I have the Alchemist Holy Cow American IPA.
Good choice. Yeah,
it is. I find that Heady Topper is like the definition of a proper New England IPA, and I'll be honest, the Holy Cow is just as bright, but it's a little tinny. It's good, but they've established such a high level of quality that I think this is a little below the Heady Topper. There's different styles, and I don't mean to suggest that the style's not as good, but there's a slight tinniness to this that I don't find in the other beers. So I'm going to give it a teeny demerit for that, but it's still well worth having. And if you're anywhere near Stowe, you should really stop by and pick up not only some of the beers, but they have wonderful socks.
Socks, huh?
Yeah, they have hops on them.
Nice.
Hop socks?
Yeah. Hop socks.
Fantastic. I'm going to break from the IPA trend that we currently have. I thought IPAs were dying down.
Not in Vermont.
Okay. I picked up, local to me, because I'm not in Vermont, Bell's Brewery, which is just what's in Michigan, but not too far away from me.
Didn't it used to be in Ohio back in the 1850s?
Not nearly.
sorry.
It's not great to have a call
coffee stout at night as we record these deep at night. Although I don't know how much caffeine.
I'm assuming the alcohol, works over the caffeine.
Maybe it balances it because this one was heavy in coffee. There's a coffee milk stout that Bell's makes called, if I can say this, Arabica Dabra. So like Arabica coffee beans, right? Arabica Dabra. Excellent. It got better as it got a little warmer. But and it wasn't so milky, but it was a heavy coffee. But I'm a coffee drinker, so it doesn't bug me at all. But that was delicious. I highly recommend it. So, Kim, that you have to drink beer or be a beer drinker.
Yeah.
Have a fortnightly beer choice to offer up to the listening folk?
You bet, you bet. I right now am enjoying, there's a local company called Seattle Cider. So they have a dry hard cider that I'm enjoying. So that's what's up tonight. Generally, I'm a Hefeweizen, so a very weedy beer person. And I would say my favorite, and maybe it's just when I lived, it was my favorite when I lived in a mountain town doing, you know, these big backpacking trips. But in Red Lodge, Montana, there's a brewery just called Red Lodge, and they have a really great Hefeweizen. So I want to plug them as well.
Okay. I'll have to look for that. I'm going to look for that. My wife is a big Hefeweizen.
Nice. Yeah.
So with that said, where can they find us out there on the interwebs? I think, Kim, you already gave your spot or your Instagram feed and website, but go ahead and give that out again.
Yeah, so I'm at McIntyreFurniture.com, and then I'm most active by a long shot on Instagram, and it's just at McIntyreFurniture.
Great, great. So, Diami, where can folks find you?
I am at the Modern Woodworkers Association.com. I am most active on Twitter these days still because I'm stubborn. And it's Diami Plotke on Twitter or Penultimate Woodshop on Instagram, where I share quite a bit also.
There you go. And I'm at SeanW78 on most social medias besides just my name, Sean Wisniewski, on Facebook. Kyle.
And you can find me on Barton.Kyle on Instagram.
And with that, that just about wraps up this show. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or Google Play Music. Or I guess it's called... Google Play Music. No, the iTunes thing.
It's Apple Podcast now, isn't it?
Apple Podcast, yeah. Just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association. There you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. While you're there, leave us a review, please.
And we thank you for listening. You can visit modernwoodworkersassociation.com. You can follow us on Twitter at @MWA_national. You can follow us on Instagram at @MWA_podcast. You can like us on Facebook or just go tell a friend about the podcast and share your woodworking. So with that, why don't you go find a community and somewhere to teach? Don't push Kim out of the way because I'm sure she's a better teacher than you. But that being said, find somewhere else to teach. And just go and share woodworking with your friends.
Absolutely.
A good practice wood, and then I was listening to this Alan Lacer. I was listening to one of his YouTube lectures, and he goes, "Yeah, poplar's the best practice wood." I'm going, "Okay, at least I'm doing that right."
Yeah, right.
But it's kind of funny because Pete Galbert swears by these oval skews. The cross section is kind of an oval.
Yeah.
And this Alan guy goes, "I hate the oval skews. In fact, I have a buyback program. I'll give you $4 for every oval skew you give me."
Wow.
He's trying to get them off the market.
Dang.
Of course, he sells his own custom skew that you can buy for about, I think just the blade is like $140 or $150. And then if you want to get a handled one, it's like $250 or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, which is, I mean, I have some of the Carter tools and they're expensive enough, but those things are, it's like, okay, well, maybe one day if I ever get good at it, I might buy his. He has some good stuff to say.
There you go.
But it's like everything. Everybody has an opinion.
Right, of course.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of it's what you learn, I guess. So I think that's what Pete learned on was oval skews, so that's why he likes them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they, I don't know why you would hate it or not. They're
He didn't really go into it because he's doing these lectures in front of like wood turning clubs. There's like two of them on the tube, on one of them on YouTube, one of them on Vimeo. And I haven't watched all the Vimeo ones, so I hope he goes into it. But on the one on YouTube, which I have watched all of it, he goes, yeah, I just hate them. He goes, there are a number of reasons, and we probably don't have time to get into that tonight. I want to know why you hate it.
It's a thing, maybe you can, well, I mean, it allows you to roll it a little easier because if it was a rectangular shank, like it would be resting really heavily on that.
But. Yeah. His deal is he likes the flat rectangular shape, but on where the short point is, the bottom of it, he likes that rounded. And then where the long point of the skew is, he likes that edge flat with the corners kind of rounded.
Sure.
That's the one, sharpening. Yeah, and that's the one he sells. And then I started looking at other manufacturers, Thompson is a big one. Their skews are just like his. And Carter, which is the one I have, both the top and the bottom are rounded. So, So anyway. But there you go. That's what I've been doing. I've been watching a bunch of videos on skews. The thing is, if I master it, I don't have to sand. And man, and after doing all these legs for these stools, I'm having to sand them. And I mean, it just destroys my shop. I mean, dust just goes everywhere.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah. So I gotta master this skew so I don't, because basically after every turning and sanding, I just gotta open up all the doors, get the leaf blower out, and go to town.